The Battle of the Taku Forts, otherwise known as the Storming of the Taku Forts, took place during the Second Opium War in 1860. In a ferocious encounter between British and French troops and the Chinese, 7 Victoria Crosses were awarded, including to the youngest recipient ever. Hi, I'm Chris Green, the History Chap, telling stories that bring British history to life. This story, which is the second of 2 episodes on this Opium War, tells the story of those VC recipients, as well as the storming of the Taku Forts in 1860, the British and French occupation of Beijing, and their forcing the Chinese to sign a peace treaty, which still impacts on China's view of the West to this day. Along the way, you will hear about the Emperor of China's summer palace being burned to the ground by the British, including the future General Charles Gordon. And you'll also learn how the future General Sir Garnet Wolseley narrowly missed being beheaded by the Chinese, and how Private John Moyes was beheaded and became a Victorian legend. So if you're ready, let's crack on. This battle, or storming of the Taku Forts, was the culmination of a series of events during the Second Opium War. Prior to this battle, the Chinese had tried to poison the British in Hong Kong and had inflicted a humiliating defeat on the British when they'd tried to storm these same Taku Forts in 1859. The defeat of the British under Admiral Hope in 1859 had elated the Chinese and shocked the British. At the time, many back in Britain saw it as their greatest defeat since Afghanistan in 1842. The only problem for the Chinese was that far from forcing the British to back down, it had the opposite effect. The British public, urged on by the press, shouted loudly for revenge, and it was a message that the hawkish Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, was only too keen to listen to. He and his French allies, and for the reason of the French involvement, please do check out my Part 1 episode, assembled a force of 11,000 British and 7,000 French troops, along with an armada of 200 frigates, gunboats and transport ships, which were sent to China. Their aim? To avenge the defeat by storming those Taku forts and marching on the Chinese capital of Peking, or Beijing. It took the expedition nearly a year to assemble at Shanghai. By May 1860, 8 British infantry regiments, along with the King's Dragoon Guards, and detachments of the Royal Marines, the Royal Engineers, and the Royal Artillery were joined by 4 Indian infantry regiments, 2 Indian cavalry regiments, and the Madras Sappers and Miners. In fact, the biggest single unit in this British army was the 15th Ludhiana Sikh Regiment, who contributed 1,000 to the British contingent. Also present were the 8th, 18th, and 19th Punjab Light Infantry. They were commanded by General Hope Grant, which is somewhat confusing when the commander of the Royal Naval Fleet was still Admiral Hope. Just to clarify, they were not related, although they were born within 4 months of each other in 1808. General Hope Grant was born in Scotland and joined the army in 1826 when he gained a commission in the 9th Lancers, a regiment that he remained with until he became a general. By the time he arrived in Shanghai, he'd fought in the First Opium War in China, the Sikh Wars in India, and most recently the Indian Revolt, also known as the Indian Mutiny. The 52-year-old was not a textbook soldier. Apart from the Bible, he rarely read. And in an age when map sketching was seen as an important skill, he could hardly draw a straight line. He was, however, a gifted cellist. A popular story is that he only ended up serving in the First Opium War because one of the senior commanders, General Lord Sultan, enjoyed playing the violin and wanted someone to play alongside him on the long journey all the way from Britain. It reminds me of a scene from Master and Commander. Anyway, he was known as a ferocious and fearless warrior. He once dismissed death as merely moving from one room to another, and his hand-to-hand fights were legendary. Famously, during the Sikh Wars, he'd arrested his own commanding officer for being drunk on the morning of a battle. He was inarticulate and often confused fellow officers with his orders, but there was no doubting that if there was a general to storm the Taku forts and avenge the recent setbacks, here was the man. Joining him as commander of the French army was General de Montauban. Also present was Lord Elgin, who'd once more been sent out by Palmerston to be the political man on the ground. The Taku forts were positioned at the mouth of the Hai River. This is the main waterway connecting Peking, Beijing, to the sea. There were actually 4 forts, 2 on the north side of the river and 2 on the south side. It was here that Admiral Hope had been humiliated the previous year, with his own flagship sunk and his Anglo-French force of marines and sailors stranded in thick mud on the riverbank, unable to move and under fire from the Chinese defenders. From his force of 1,000 men, Hope had lost nearly 100 killed and 250 wounded. General Hope Grant was wary of repeating Admiral Hope's mistake. There would be no advance through the mud. Instead, his force sailed past the forts, bombarding them as they went, and landed about 10 miles upriver on the 10th of August, 1860. From there, they approached the two forts on the northern bank from the landward side. The British, or British Indian Army, was divided into two brigades. The first commanded by Major General Sir John Mitchell, and the second by Major General Sir Robert Napier. Napier was another veteran of the recent Indian or Sepoy mutiny, and would go on to lead the British invasion of Abyssinia, modern-day Ethiopia, in 1867. His campaign there and his victory at Magdala are blueprints for military and logistical planning, but are largely forgotten. Anyway, back to the Taku Forts, 1860. Would it be a case of third time lucky? As the Allies advanced, they had to drive off a determined attack by Tartar cavalry on the 12th of August. That same day, a small party of Sikh and British soldiers were ambushed and captured by the Chinese. From this arose one of the great legends, or myths, of this war. One of the captured soldiers was Private John Moyse of the 3rd Regiment of Foot, later the East Kent Regiment, also known as the Buffs. The legend goes that he, along with the other captured soldiers, was brought in front of a local mandarin and told to kowtow or prostrate themselves on pain of death. Of the captured soldiers, only Private Moyse refused to do so. When the other prisoners were released a week later, it was reported that Moyse had been beaten, beheaded, and his body tossed on a dung heap. Unlike those survivors who presumably had kowtowed, Moyse had refused to humiliate himself or his country, and as a later poem by Sir Francis Hastings Doyle said, "Not through him shall England come to shame." Sterling stuff. The Chinese claimed that Moyse had not refused because of a sense of patriotism, but because he was drunk and being awkward. They actually claimed he died of alcohol poisoning and hadn't been beheaded at all. Colonel Garnet Wolseley, who as General Sir Garnet Wolseley would end up as Commander-in-Chief of the British Army, was on this expedition. Despite being an uber-patriot and imperialist, Wolseley dismissed the story of Moyse being some sort of martyr for the British Empire. The story, he noted, was told by a fellow prisoner from the 44th Regiment of Foot, who was, Wolseley sourly noted, a very unreliable character. The Manchester Times also carried a report from a doctor accompanying the expedition, who also poured cold water on this story. Nevertheless, the story of a brave, patriotic redcoat refusing to kowtow before the heathen Chinese was a story that the British public wanted to hear. And they did, not least thanks to Doyle's poem, entitled The Private of the Buffs. Interestingly, he was the only member of the Buffs killed in the storming of the Taku Forts. During the night of the 20th to 21st of August, the Allied force moved into position in the darkness and positioned their artillery about 600 yards from the walls of the northern forts. The French, who had advocated attacking the southern forts and believed that attacking the northern bastions was folly, only decided to join in the attack at the last minute, so despite their overall numbers in the army, only about 400 men plus two artillery batteries took part in the initial attack that morning. As the sun rose on the 21st of August, 1860, the Chinese could see the Allied dispositions, and at 5 a.m, the defenders opened up with every cannon in their possession. The Allied artillery and navy returned fire, trying to both silence the Chinese guns and breach the walls of the forts. Now the French infantry and the British 67th and 44th Regiments of Foot were ordered to advance with scaling ladders. Their advance was hampered by defensive dikes, many filled with sharpened bamboo stakes. And as they closed in, they came under musket and arrow fire. And on reaching the walls, the Chinese defenders poured caustic lime down onto them. When they placed their ladders against the walls, the Chinese pushed them back, or in some cases, pulled them up, thus depriving the British and French of their use. The British would suffer 200 casualties that morning, whilst the French suffered a further 158. 15-year-old apprentice Arthur Fitzgibbon, who was serving in the Indian medical establishment, like the medical corps, but attached to the 67th, ran through no man's land to rescue a wounded soldier, and was himself wounded in the process. Napier now ordered two howitzers up to within 50 yards of the main gate and proceeded to bombard it. An officer from the Royal Engineers, along with Hope Grant's aide-de-camp, Major Anson, rushed forward and under a hail of bullets and arrows, cut the ropes to the drawbridge. It was like some Hollywood film, the drawbridge crashing down and the British, Indian and French troops rushing across. But the drawbridge didn't budge. The artillery had, however, managed to punch a hole through the wall nearby. It was now that Lieutenant Henry Burslem of the 67th Regiment of Foot rushed forward. The 67th had been raised during the Seven Years' War in 1756 and would later become the Hampshire Regiment. Despite being hit in the chest by a Chinese shot, 23-year-old Lieutenant Burslem from Limerick in Ireland rushed to that gap in the massive wall and, grabbing a pickaxe, proceeded to enlarge it for the men behind. Under fire from muskets and arrows, not to mention that caustic lime, another officer, Lieutenant Henry Lennon, ran to his aid and thrust his sword into the mud wall to create a step. 20-year-old ensign John Chaplin leapt up and planted the Queen's colour in the breach. Despite being hit in the forearm, shoulder and the abdomen, he stood fending off the Chinese defenders until joined by Private Thomas Lane from his regiment. The first British soldier to rush past them and enter the Taku Fort was not actually from the 67th, but from the 44th Regiment of Foot. The 44th Regiment of Foot, who were to become the Essex Regiment, had been formed in 1741 and had first seen action during the 1745 Jacobite Rebellion at the Battle of Preston Pans. They'd gone on to fight in the American Revolutionary Wars, the French Revolutionary Wars, where they'd served at the Battle of Alexandria in Egypt, the War of 1812 against the Americans, and the Napoleonic Wars, both in the Peninsula Campaign and at Waterloo. It was at the Battle of Salamanca during the Peninsula War that Lieutenant William Pierce of the 44th had captured a French eagle. Of course, it was also the 44th who'd been almost wiped out in the retreat from Kabul in 1842. And I've told the story of their final stand at Gandamag in a previous video. Check it out at the end. And now to that illustrious history, two more names were to be added. Lieutenant Robert Rogers of the 44th ran up to the wall and, using that sword as a bit of a springboard, vaulted up into the breach. He was followed by Private McGugal, also of the 44th. Both men would be awarded the Victoria Cross. Five men from the 67th would also be awarded Britain's highest medal for valour. Lieutenants Burslem and Lennon, Ensign Chaplin, who had entered the breach with the Queen's colour, Private Thomas Lane, who had stood there with him fending off the Chinese, and finally the medical apprentice, Arthur Fitzgibbon. At the time, it was the most VCs ever awarded for a single action. It would be surpassed by the defenders of Rorke's Drift during the Zulu War of 1879. And whilst that record therefore soon faded, one record does remain. At 15 years of age, Arthur Fitzgibbon is the youngest ever recipient of the Victoria Cross. Some people might point out that another 15-year-old, Thomas Flynn, was awarded the VC during the Indian Mutiny. Unfortunately, his exact date of birth is unknown. So at 15 years and 3 months, Fitzgibbon is acknowledged by the National Army Museum as the youngest recipient. So I'll go with their wisdom. The Buffs and the 8th Punjab Native Infantry were now ordered on to the 2nd of the forts on the north bank. Having been under fire from the naval forces and just seen their fellow fort overwhelmed, the Chinese defenders abandoned their positions. Meanwhile, over on the south bank, the defenders of those forts realised they were now in an untenable position and raised a white flag in surrender. By the end of the day, 21st of August 1860, all the forts were in Allied hands. The Chinese had lost somewhere in the region of 1,500 men, plus a further 2,000 captured. They'd also lost over 400 guns. The Allied losses were in the region of 350 dead and wounded. The heaviest casualties had been borne by the 67th Regiment of Foot, with 6 killed and 71 wounded. Whilst not as bad as Admiral Hope's previous effort, those overall Allied casualty figures do bear testament to the ferocity of the defence. Indeed, the British were amazed that some Chinese gunners had manned their guns to the very end. It was only afterwards that it was discovered that their officers had actually tied them to their guns. The Taku forts were finally in Allied hands, but the war still had some way to go. There would be more battles, more brutality, more destruction. And I'll finish off by exploring those events. The British and French now advanced on the Chinese capital, Peking, now called Beijing. They hadn't gone too far when they received a letter from the Emperor's nephew offering to negotiate. Harry Parkes, who appeared in the last episode, had been brought up from Canton by Elgin due to his extensive knowledge of China and fluency in Chinese. He was now dispatched to a meeting with the Chinese, along with a small escort of a few officers and a troop of Sikh cavalry. But rather than entering into talks, Parkes and his party of 36 were seized and bound by the Chinese. When Parkes didn't return, Lord Elgin and General Hope Grant realised that Chinese offers of negotiation were just a sham and continued their advance on Peking. On the 21st of September, 1860, at the Battle of Palikao, the Allied force of 10,000 defeated a Chinese army twice their size. A charge by 2,000 Tartar cavalry was driven off by the 99th Regiment of Foot. The 99th Lanarkshire Regiment had only been raised in the 1820s and would later see action in the Zulu War at the Battle of Ginginlovu. In the Childers reforms of 1881, they were renamed the Duke of Edinburgh's Wiltshire Regiment. As the Chinese recoiled from the fire of the 99th, the King's Dragoon Guards, along with the 1st Sikh Cavalry, charged and cleared the field. Meanwhile, the French attacked the Chinese positions, storming a narrow bridge. The thankful French Emperor, Napoleon III, awarded General Montauban with the title Comte de Palikao in honour of the battle. Napoleon III was the nephew of the great Napoleon Bonaparte and father of the Prince Imperial, who was killed during the Zulu War. Now almost at Peking, the Allies seized the Emperor's vacant summer palace. The name palace doesn't really do it justice. We're not talking about a single building, but a series of buildings, more like a small city than Buckingham Palace. The French, who arrived first, looted the complex completely. There wasn't a lot left when the British turned up, but they joined in plundering what little remained. Elgin was appalled by the destruction, but he was even more appalled when Harry Parkes arrived, having been released from captivity. However, 16 of his party had not been so fortunate. Most had died whilst being tortured. One officer, Captain Brabazon, had been beheaded. Brabazon must have rued his misfortune. He had eagerly volunteered to join Parkes because the officer who should have been accompanying the consul was lacking behind sketching maps of the terrain. And that officer's name? Garnet Wolseley. How history may have been very different if it had been Wolseley who had been beheaded. No Red River expedition in Canada. No Ashanti War in modern-day Ghana. Certainly no Ashanti ring of officers. No Tel el Kebir in Egypt. And I wonder what would have happened to the attempts to rescue Charles Gordon in Khartoum if Wolseley hadn't been in charge. Or indeed, whether Gordon would have gone at all. And I guess that Gilbert and Sullivan might not have had a very model for their modern Major General in Pirates of Penzance. It's those small moments that make history, as well as the big events. Elgin wanted to extract revenge from the Chinese for the torture and murder of the men accompanying Parkes to that peace meeting. The capture, binding, torturing and murdering of Parkes' party seemed to underline the intransigent, aloof stance that the Chinese adopted towards foreign barbarians. After all, Parkes was proceeding under a flag of truce to a meeting arranged by the Emperor's nephew. Elgin realised that with his army almost at the gates of Peking, the Chinese would adopt their usual ploy of smoke and mirrors. If he demanded that the men responsible for the torture and killings be surrendered, he knew that they would offer up some minor scapegoats whilst any senior officials, in other words those who had actually ordered the murders, would escape scot-free. He needed to make a statement which the upper echelons of the imperial government would take notice of. And so, despite his previous horror at the looting, he ordered the summer palace to be burnt to the ground. It took two whole days to set fire to the whole complex. One British officer in charge at the sacking was a 27-year-old captain from the Royal Engineers, Charles Gordon, the future Gordon of Khartoum. Despite doing his duty, he wrote to his mother that he was appalled at the destruction of the magnificent buildings. On the 13th of October, General Sir Robert Napier marched into Peking through a gate that the Chinese had surrendered. There would be no fighting in the imperial capital. Accompanied by Harry Parkes, they rode through a silent city as ash from the burning summer palace slowly drifted down like snow. Just over a week later, on the 24th, Elgin himself entered the city in a procession of over 600 soldiers and 100 officers, led by a detachment of cavalry. He was carried in a sedan chair by 16 crimson-robed Chinese. The proud Chinese government were both shocked and bewildered. The capital of the Celestial Empire had been occupied by barbarian armies. The Emperor, who had vacated Beijing long before the Allied armies had drawn anywhere near, sent his younger brother, Prince Kong, to begin negotiations in earnest. When the 37-year-old prince met Elgin, he was suddenly spooked when a photographer stepped forward and pointed his camera at the men. Once he was assured that it wasn't a gun, he acquiesced to having his photo taken. Unfortunately for history, the photographer botched the shot, and whilst Prince Kong later sat for another photo, we have no photo of this historic meeting between Prince Kong and Lord Elgin. The ensuing Convention of Peking confirmed and extended the Treaty of Tientsin signed 2 years previously. As well as the previous provisions, The port of Tianjin was added to the other 10 ports that were to be open to British ships, and the indemnity to be paid by the Chinese was doubled from $4 to $8 million. And there was more. British ships would be allowed to carry indentured Chinese labourers to the Americas. So many of North and South America's Chinese long-time populations are there because of this treaty. And finally, the mainland peninsula directly opposite the island of Hong Kong would be ceded to Britain. Later in the century, the British would lease more of the mainland, the new territories, for their colony. And it was this lease that ran out in 1997 when the British handed Hong Kong back to China. So in theory, as the island and this tiny portion of Kowloon up to Boundary Road, for those of you who know Hong Kong, were not covered by the lease, they could have been retained by Britain. As it was, the British government decided that such a small territory was untenable, and the whole colony reverted to China. Back to 1860. The Allied armies stayed in Peking until the reparations were paid in November, and then departed. The animosity and sense of grievance amongst the Chinese at this and other so-called unequal treaties did not depart so easily. 40 years later, it would result in the Boxer Rebellion, that Chinese nationalist rising, and the plight of the besieged Western legations or embassies in Peking provided the backdrop for the 1960s film 55 Days at Peking, starring David Niven, Charlton Heston and Ava Gardner. So as you can tell from my two episodes, the Second Opium War has been a long story. Actually, it's been a whole series of sub-stories. The attempted mass poisoning of the British in Hong Kong, Admiral Hope's disastrous attempts to storm the Taku forts, Josiah Tatnall, the American, coming to his rescue, General Hope Grant's successful storming of those same Taku forts, 7 Victoria Crosses awarded in that single action, Garnet Wolseley missing execution because he was just making some sketches, the sacking of the Summer Palace, the unequal treaties of Tianjin and Peking, and all those incredible characters from 19th century British history. Charles Gordon, Jackie Fisher, General Gerald Graham, the hero of El Teb and Tamai in Sudan. And there are so many more. I mean, what happened to Admiral Hope or General Grant or Harry Parkes? And what about the men awarded the Victoria Crosses? Well, let me tell you now. The much maligned Admiral Hope somehow managed to restore his reputation and remained in the Royal Navy. Somewhat ironically, based upon his experiences at the Taku Forts, he would then serve alongside the Imperial Chinese Army during the suppression of the Taiping Rebellion, where he'd once again be wounded in the leg. Another British officer serving the Imperial Chinese during the Taiping Rebellion was Charles Gordon. It was from this conflict that he would earn the nickname Chinese Gordon. He more famously ended up in Khartoum, and I've told his story in another episode. Admiral Hope would die aged 73 near Linlithgow, Scotland, in 1881. General Hope Grant would return to Britain and a hero's welcome. Following a stint as Commander-in-Chief of the Madras Army in India, he would end up as Quartermaster General of the British Army and Camp Commandant at Aldershot. In these two positions, he reformed army manoeuvres and introduced both war games and military lectures. He was a major influence on his successor, Garnet Wolseley. General Grant died in 1875. Lord Elgin would serve as Britain's first minister or ambassador in Peking, before being appointed Viceroy of India in 1862. Immersing himself in his new role with his usual mixture of decency and hard work, he would die from a heart attack the following year. Of the Victoria Cross recipients, Robert Rogers, the first man to leap into the breach at the Taku Forts in 1860, would go on to command the 90th Regiment, the Cameroonians, during the Zulu War, and died peacefully in Berkshire in 1895. Lieutenant Edmund Lennon of the 67th died in 1893 at the age of 52. He is buried at Kensal Green Cemetery in London, which is almost like a hero's corner from British history. You will find Isambard Kingdom Brunel, William Makepeace Thackeray, and early computing pioneer Charles Babbage. Also buried at Kensal Green is Admiral Sir George Elliot, who you may recall commanded the Royal Navy during the first part of the First Opium War. From the modern era, Kensal Green also contains the ashes of Christine Keeler from The Profumo Affair, celebrity chef Gary Rhodes, and actor Alan Rickman, Professor Snape from Harry Potter, as well as Hans Gruber in Die Hard, and the almost pantomime-style Sheriff of Nottingham in Kevin Costner's Robin Hood. The other officer from the 67th to win the Victoria Cross at the Taku Forts, Lieutenant Nathaniel Burslem, left the army and emigrated to New Zealand, where he drowned in a canoeing accident. The oldest survivor was Ensign John Chaplin, who planted the Queen's colour on the breach. He would eventually rise to the rank of colonel and died aged 87 at Market Harbour in Leicestershire in 1920. Arthur Fitzgibbon, the youngest ever recipient of the Victoria Cross, stayed in the medical section of the Indian Army and rose to become an apothecary before dying at Delhi in 1883. He was just 37. And what are the two Britons who played such an instrumental role at the outbreak of the war, right at the beginning of this story in episode one? Sir John Bowring left a legacy in Hong Kong with his establishment of the Botanical Gardens. Once his tenure as governor ended, he returned to Britain. En route, he was shipwrecked on a coral reef in the Red Sea. He later headed up a government trade mission to Italy, but his health started to decline due to the effects of that arsenic in the bread all those years before in Hong Kong. He died in his native Exeter in 1872. Harry Parkes spent the rest of his life serving Britain as a diplomat in East Asia. He acted as an aide to Elgin when he was ambassador to Peking, before heading back to Canton and then Shanghai as British consul. From 1865, he spent 17 years in Japan, where he survived three assassination attempts. He was finally appointed British ambassador to China in 1883, and died in Peking 2 years later, from malaria. And speaking of Peking and China, the emperor died just 1 year after the sacking of his summer palace and the humiliating peace treaty. His one-year-old son assumed the throne, but a regency was established with the Dowager Empress running the country. She would remain de facto ruler for the next 40 years and plays a key role in the Boxer Rebellion in 1900. And that story of the Boxer Rebellion, the siege of the foreign legations as told in the film 55 Days at Peking, and the attempts of Admiral Seymour's nephew to rescue them, is the subject of a recent episode. In many ways, it has a direct link to Chinese grievances coming out of both the First and Second Opium Wars and the storming of the Taku Forts and the Peking Convention. And as I said at the beginning of this talk, it influences Chinese attitudes to the West to this day. After all, we are all products of history. Check out my 55 Days at Peking and also the First Opium War episodes if you haven't already. Alternatively, why not listen to my episodes on both General Charles Gordon and General Sir Garnet Wolseley? Both men had a huge impact on British military campaigns in the latter part of the 19th century. And if you enjoy my work and want to support me, then please consider joining my supporters club. Click on the subscribe button below. Plenty more stories from British history coming your way. But until then, thanks for joining me today. Keep well, and I'll speak to you again very soon.